Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. This week, the U.S. Supreme Court sidestepped two cases without ruling on whether they are constitutional related to how congressional districts are drawn. Many had hoped the court would provide an answer to whether maps in Wisconsin and Maryland were gerrymandered. Will there be an impact in Pennsylvania that has been at the epicenter of a redistricting battle this year? Joining us for analysis is political science professor Dr. Kyle Kopko of Elizabethtown College. Dr. Kopko, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, so I'll ask the main question right up front, Dr. Kopko. What impact will this Supreme Court action or inaction have on Pennsylvania?
In the short term, there's going to be no immediate impact. It's basically the status quo for what we've seen since the state Supreme Court ruled in January and February of this year. So what the Supreme Court essentially did was kick the can down the road. They ruled that the litigants in these cases didn't have standing. They didn't close off these cases entirely. It's going to go back down to the lower courts to litigate further, and it's possible that they could come back to the U.S. Supreme Court. So until all those cases are relitigated and there is a definitive answer at the U.S. Supreme Court, we shouldn't really expect anything to change since the state Supreme Court's decision earlier this year.
For those who haven't followed this here in Pennsylvania closely over the last 6 months or so, you're going to hear a lot of talk about Supreme Courts. And there, you know, what we're talking about this week was the U.S. Supreme Court. And as Dr. Kopko mentioned, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court had a big hand in what happened here in Pennsylvania. Now, you just said short-term nothing or very little, long-term, maybe something. What are you talking about long-term?
So in the long-term, this could be something that if the U.S. Supreme Court rules that they do have the ability to decide these cases, or at least craft a rule by which they can remedy these cases, that's the most important thing. That would then provide litigants an opportunity to go into federal court, not just in Pennsylvania, but in any state in the country, to litigate partisan gerrymander claims. So now, because of the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court decision earlier this year, our state courts can now hear claims against congressional or legislative districts that have been partisan gerrymanders.
Oh, really? Now, okay. Explain how that would happen.
So basically, if a voter or an elected official were to allege that their district was crafted in a way to disadvantage a political party, to dilute their votes, so-called packing or cracking of voters, putting a lot of voters of the same political party in one district so that way they have less influence throughout the entire state, or breaking up a district so that way voters in a certain geographic area don't have the opportunity to elect a candidate of their choice. If that's all done on the basis of the voter's political party, that could be subject to a lawsuit, and judges would then have to determine if this redistricting scheme that was adopted was illegal. Was it unconstitutional under the Pennsylvania state constitution? That's the key issue here.
Just so, you know, I want to provide some clarity to our listeners out there, just so we know, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, just to kind of go through this quickly, you know, there were a number of voters from each congressional district here in Pennsylvania that went to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court saying that the districts that were drawn in the early part of this decade were gerrymandered to favor the party in the majority, which at that time still is, Republicans. The court ruled that they had a case, so ordered ordered the legislature to come back with some alternative maps. Republicans did. Supreme Court shot them down, told the governor's office to submit some maps too, shot those down, then consulted their own experts, and the Pennsylvania Supreme Court then came up with a map of its own using maps submitted by their own experts. A lot of controversy about whether the Pennsylvania Supreme Court overstepped its bounds, doing legislation in place of the legislators. So that kind of brings us up to where we are right now. So right. I guess my question is, at this point, because I think a lot of people thought that after the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruled, and there were those, even in the Pennsylvania legislature, who appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court didn't take the case, that was the end of it for now until the next time that the legislature or whatever's in place at that time, maps are redrawn. Is that accurate?
Well, in the future, essentially, if the U.S. Supreme Court allows these partisan gerrymander cases to go forward and they craft a remedy, it would essentially allow litigants in Pennsylvania to have two bites at the apple. That's the best way I can describe it. They could then have the opportunity to litigate a partisan gerrymander case in state courts or in the federal courts. Right now, we don't have a definitive answer on whether or not this would work in the federal courts, given the U.S. Supreme Court's rulings in Gill versus Whitford. But for now, we do have the remedial plan in place for Pennsylvania based upon the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court, and that will remain in effect until the next round of redistricting, which should start in 2021.
I want to go back a little bit, and I will be jumping around here, Dr. Kopko, and I hope this is for our listeners, because this can be confusing in that there are so many entities involved here. It's somewhat misleading, and I use the word sidestepped. It's somewhat misleading to say this U.S. Supreme Court sidestepped these cases. The two cases before them, which they combined from Wisconsin and Maryland, the court's action had nothing to do with the constitutionality of the cases. And just to provide some background, in the Maryland case, the court said the challengers moved too slowly and there was not enough time to orderly consider the case before the 2018 election season. In the Wisconsin case, which you just mentioned, Gill versus Whitford, the justices ruled unanimously that the Democratic voters challenging a state legislative map drawn in 2011 failed to prove that they were injured by the drawing of the new boundaries. However, seven justices agreed to give the challengers another shot at making their case in the lower courts, as you referred to. So just to provide some background there, that really isn't a technicality. It is that the U.S. Supreme Court, and notice one of the key words there, unanimous. There are very few unanimous decisions in the U.S. Supreme Court today. The justices that ruled all decided that along these grounds that these cases should be sent back to the federal courts, right?
Right. So there's a couple different things going on here. So just to provide some background for listeners, the federal courts or state courts for that matter, they will not take up a case unless if they are certain that a litigant has suffered some sort of harm or injury. They don't want to decide hypothetical cases or cases in which they're not entirely certain to what extent someone has been injured. And that essentially is what the Supreme Court said in the Wisconsin case. And the reason why is the voters in that case challenged the Wisconsin legislative district plan statewide. And what this U.S. Supreme Court asked is to provide evidence on a district-by-district basis for each of the litigants that they had suffered some sort of harm. They weren't able to elect the types of candidates that they otherwise would have been entitled to if there was a different type of map in place. So they're not closing the door on this. They want clarity from the lower courts as to what the actual injury is for each one of these litigants. Once they have that information from the trial courts in Wisconsin, then they can decide if they can deliver a decision on the constitutionality of the districting plan.
These cases had to come through federal courts before they made it to the U.S. Supreme Court. Why didn't the federal courts make this decision before it made it to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, there's always going to be some disagreement between the lower courts at the federal level and the U.S. Supreme Court, particularly in cases like this where the law isn't especially clear and there's been a lot of debate as to whether or not these types of cases are what we call justiciable. Are they even cases that the courts have the capacity to hear? And Justice Antonin Scalia, for example, took a very hard line in arguing that partisan gerrymander cases just should not be heard by the federal courts at all because they are so inherently political that the courts just simply can't come up with a good remedy for any of these issues. There are things that are best left to the political process, best left to voters and elected officials to sort out. Now, obviously, there's some disagreement by legal scholars, court observers, and even members of the United States Supreme Court, and this has been going on since the 1970s. And these cases aren't going away. Sooner or later, the Supreme Court is going to have to take a definitive stand on whether or not they can come up with a manageable remedy for these types of legal challenges, or just say the federal courts cannot hear these claims at all, in which case litigants are either out of luck or they could try to follow the Pennsylvania model and litigate these in a state court instead.
And I'm not looking for you to quote passages, but what does the U.S. Constitution say about redistricting?
Well, the reapportionment process is left up to the state legislatures. And this is all based upon population changes in the course of the census. Obviously, the Supreme Court has interpreted the Constitution many times, dating back to the 1960s. With Reynolds versus Sims and Baker versus Carr discussing malapportionment in the redistricting process, noting that districts roughly have to be equal in size based upon the Equal Protection Clause of the United States Constitution in the 14th Amendment. Obviously, racial gerrymanders are illegal. They are unconstitutional. But the word gerrymander appears nowhere in the United States Constitution. A lot of this is based upon judicial interpretation. Obviously, gerrymanders have a very long history in the United States. But this is mainly an area of judge-made law.
So, you know, I you know, listening to your description, and that's interesting what Justice Scalia had to say about it, that it's something that the courts shouldn't be deciding. But I think you're right that ultimately the U.S. Supreme Court is going to have to make a decision. In fact, the next case having to do with redistricting will come from North Carolina. And as you said earlier, these two cases could come back before the court. But and you kind of touched on this, but ultimately the court will be asked to decide whether these congressional maps are gerrymandered or not. And by gerrymandered meaning that meant to favor one party over another or someone over or someone else. So how would that have to happen? What will the court look at if indeed some of these cases, they finally do rule on some of these cases?
That's the multi-million dollar question. So let's back up just a little bit to the mid-2000s. So the last time before Gill versus Whitford that there was a major partisan gerrymander case before the U.S. Supreme Court was Veith versus Jubilier. It was a Pennsylvania gerrymandering case. And this is the one that was highly fractured and where Justice Scalia said we just should not entertain these types of cases as the Supreme Court, whereas the liberal justices on the court wanted to hear these types of cases and fashion a remedy. And Justice Kennedy was in the middle. And he was really the key vote, and he's the one who's kind of guiding case law here as we move forward with these cases. He said that despite the fact that the Supreme Court could not determine a way of resolving these cases whenever the Pennsylvania gerrymander came before the court in Veith versus Jubilier, despite that, we still might be able to think of a way of remedying these cases in the future. And the federal court should still hear these cases. Litigants should have the opportunity to offer up potential remedies, so on and so forth. And what happened more recently is some political scientists have tried to develop various measures to determine if a district is unlawfully gerrymandered. And what was at the core of the Gill versus Whitford case here was something called the efficiency gap. Two scholars, Nick Stephanopoulos and Aaron McGee, who have legal training and social science training, developed this measure where it essentially measures the extent to which there are votes that are wasted in a given district. So are there many more votes for a winning candidate that were needed to win? So if you just need a majority plus one to win an election, how many more votes beyond that were cast? How many were wasted, or how many were wasted for the losing candidate? So it's not a perfect measure, but it's something that's been offered. It's something that the Supreme Court, at least through Justice Kennedy's opinion, has hinted that they need something to help guide them in determining how to resolve these cases, because there's no real guidance in the United States Constitution, and what constitutes gerrymander is really subjective. We might be able to know it when we see it, but how do you craft that into law? How do you create a judicial opinion that discusses for future cases how to remedy these types of legal disputes? That's really the big question. And so far, this efficiency gap measure has probably been the most popular measure in the political science and social science literature today to help courts do this. Whether the U.S. Supreme Court ultimately decides to adopt that whenever they have the ability to rule on the merits of the case, we're just going to have to wait and see. We don't have any clarification on that quite yet.
But that formula that you just mentioned, Chief Justice John Roberts seemed to discount it. He said the problem with the test that it measures the effect a gerrymander has on the fortunes of political parties, not individual voters. And that's what the courts would be looking for, voters rather than the parties, right?
Correct. And he actually went further in the oral arguments and called it sociological gobbledygook, to the chagrin of many court observers. And honestly, it's really tough. I'm going to be honest. This is something that is exceptionally hard to define. And reasonable people will disagree on this. And even if the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, comes up with a standard, not everyone's going to be happy with it, because this is such an amorphous concept. You just can't nail it down.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up a little bit later in the program, we're going to be talking about Parkinson's disease. Probably heard that former Governor Ed Rendell announced this week that he has been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. We'll be discussing Parkinson's a little bit later in the program. But right now we're joined by political science professor Dr. Kyle Kopko of Elizabethtown College. We're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court ruling or action taken earlier this week that basically sends a couple of redistricting cases, gerrymandering cases, back to the federal courts, and how Pennsylvania has been impacted or won't be impacted by that ruling. If you have a question or a comment, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. As you were describing it, Dr. Kopko, of what plaintiffs that bring cases to the courts would have to show that they were injured in some way by a congressional map. I know, just looking at it on the surface, that seems like it would be a tough challenge, something to prove, just because of what you said a little bit earlier, that there's no real set in stone formula. It's one of those things that, famously, there was a Supreme Court justice who would say, I don't know how to define pornography, but I recognize it if I see it. I hate to say it, but that sounds like the kind of explanation we're getting with this.
In many ways, it is. And dating back to the 1940s, the U.S. Supreme Court recognized that this is going to be a political hot potato. And one of the reasons why they don't want to tackle these types of issues, or why they're more reluctant to do that, is that this can affect the legitimacy of courts. The last thing that any judge wants is to be perceived as a partisan hack, deciding a case that's going to favor or disadvantage one political party. That's simply a type of controversy that they want to avoid. And so whenever litigants now are taking up these cases, they're doing their best to try to provide clear empirical evidence, clear data as to why a certain district or set of districts is gerrymandered. And it could be this efficiency gap in the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court case. A political scientist from the University of Michigan actually ran a number of computer simulations to redraw Pennsylvania's district lines to see how often they could replicate or come close to the district maps that were created by the legislature. So it's basically this broad swath of options that are presented to the courts, and it's going to be up to the judgment of the courts to determine what's best, if anything at all.
You know, I have to admit that I smiled a little bit when you said that the no judge wants to be considered a political hack. I can just see a campaign for appellate court judge. I am not a political hack. That would be a first, the first time that that you heard that. We had a question here from a listener, Jim, who was on the road, by the way, and tuning in. And it's a good question. Why has there not been a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the current state House and state Senate districts based on the Pennsylvania state constitution?
There could be, and I think the process for drawing the lines between the General Assembly and the congressional districts differs greatly. And that's also one of the reasons why the General Assembly has been considering a number of options to recreate the way that they draw congressional district lines. So for the General Assembly, there's a commission that draws the district lines. So these are individuals who are members of the legislature, but the chairman is someone who members of the majority caucus and the minority caucus agree to appoint, and that's normally the swing vote. Usually someone who is supposed to be more independent or moderate. For the past few election redistricting cycles, though, for the General Assembly, no one could agree on who the chairman was, so then that fell to the state Supreme Court to appoint a chairman, and normally it ends up being a retired judge. And then that commission draws the district lines. And because it's removed from the legislature and because it's supposedly more balanced in terms of partisan makeup, split evenly between Democrats and Republicans, and then a chairman who is supposedly independent, that helps to insulate those district lines from challenges. Now, they could still be subject to a lawsuit. Courts could still certainly consider them, particularly now in light of the state Supreme Court's decision. They could still be subject to a partisan gerrymander lawsuit, but the odds of success are a bit diminished because of how that process works, because it's removed from the General Assembly. For congressional districts, to date, it's been up to the House and the Senate to craft district lines for members of Congress. So it is an inherently political process, and it's not just a partisan process, but there's lots and lots of negotiating behind closed doors, considering the effect of wanting to protect incumbent members of Congress, too, and drawing district lines in that manner, also trying to balance community interests, so you're not splitting up counties or municipalities. But when partisan considerations creep into the mix, we want to make sure that we maximize our partisan advantage, and most of the members of the Pennsylvania delegation are on our side, those types of things. That's going to open up those types of cases to a challenge.
Well, to date was, that was two of the key words that you used when describing that. The Pennsylvania legislature is looking at redistricting bills right now. One that has gotten the most attention, we had Senator Mike Fulmer, who is one of the sponsors of the bill a few weeks ago on the program, would include a commission to draw maps that, but the part that threw everyone is tying the election of statewide appellate court judges to districts. You get the sense. Now, this is just as an observer. I have no insight into this. But just as an observer, it appeared that this Senate Bill 22 had a chance of passing. And there was a deadline because they wanted to get it passed before July 6th so that it could be implemented the next time that the congressional boundaries were redrawn. Seemed to have a chance. A lot of people now have jumped off the bandwagon with this because of tying appellate court judge elections to the redistricting process. So what do you make of this?
I'm not confident that they're going to enact this anytime in the future. Certainly we could have reform where we change the manner in which we select judges. Certainly we could have reform where we change the manner in which we redraw congressional district lines. But I think doing both of them together is going to be too much for the General Assembly to do in this legislative session. So what will probably end up happening is we'll maintain the status quo for how we draw congressional district lines, which means that the House and the Senate would have the authority to do that. There's nothing inherently wrong with that, but it still means that there could be these partisan gerrymander claims raised in the future as we go into redistricting in 2021.
You know, I say this to a lot of people, Kyle, that 2-3 years ago, if I walked up to someone on the street and said, let's talk about reapportionment, let's talk about congressional redistricting, let's talk about gerrymandering, you could literally see their eyes glaze over. It is a huge issue, not only in this state now, but across the country. Why?
Well, I think there's an issue of fairness involved, and also the technological processes that legislatures use to draw district lines have become much more sophisticated than what they were in the past. So in the 1970s and 1980s, you would have map makers sitting around the table with colored pencils on a map, you know, by hand, trying to craft district lines and take into account population inequalities and things like that. But now, because of computer technology, you can micro-target voters within certain districts. So you can become much more precise, which means also that districts can look funny, you know, like the old 7th congressional district that used to be represented by Pat Meehan. Everyone across the country seemed to make fun of that shape, saying it looked like Goofy kicking Donald Duck in the head or something to that effect.
In the butt, actually.
And the reason why it looked that way is because there were sophisticated tools at a legislature's disposal to craft a district in such a manner. And it wasn't just for partisan reasons, it was also for incumbent protection reasons. There's a wide variety of reasons why a district might have an odd shape to it. But ultimately, it's that appearance and also the fact that you could have a discrepancy in, say, the statewide voting percentages. Maybe you might have a majority of voters statewide voting for one party, but the congressional delegation, a majority of them would be affiliated with the opposite political party. So some folks would say, hey, that seems kind of funny. There's a disconnect there. Shouldn't there be a majority of the same party in the congressional delegation if that's the way the votes shook out at the state level? So I think for all those reasons, that folks are becoming more and more aware of the importance of redistricting. And obviously, too, the House of Representatives in the 2018 election is up for grabs. I think all these things together have raised awareness of voters and brought a level of heightened scrutiny that we haven't seen in years past.
Dr. Kyle Kopko is a political science professor at the Elizabethtown College. Dr. Kopko, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Former Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell announced publicly earlier this week that he is battling Parkinson's disease. Rendell indicated he was diagnosed with Parkinson's 3 years ago and is being treated. So what is Parkinson's disease? Joining us today is neurologist Dr. Thyagarajan Subramanian of Penn State Health's Hershey Medical Center. Dr. Subramanian, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, so what is Parkinson's disease?
Well, Parkinson's disease is a neurodegenerative disorder, and it is usually manifesting in mostly elderly people around the age of 60, 60 plus. Typical age of onset is around 65, although there are some people who do get it earlier. And it's characterized by three cardinal symptoms. Number one is a tremor. This is shaking of one or more limbs. And this is the one thing that brings people's attention to the disease. And this is also the face of the disease, so to speak. In addition, they have what we call bradykinesia. Brady means slow. Kinesis means movement. So slow movement. So they become slow in everything that they do. Facial expression, arm swing, walking, balance, dexterity task, all of them become slow. And then finally, there is this last thing that goes with it, which is called rigidity, which is is actually a sign, which means a doctor, nurse, or a physical therapist elicits that sign on examining the patient. The patient themselves don't feel this, although sometimes people think that they feel stiff. That's really not the case. They are just slow, and the slowness makes it look like they are stiff. So those three symptoms were the first description. Now, there are other things that come with it, like balance loss, which Ed Randall mentioned in his opinion piece. Yes, they can have balance loss. But typically, balance loss happens later in the disease. Initially, it just manifests the first three symptoms that I mentioned. I also want to take the opportunity to congratulate the governor for coming out public, because it's important that people recognize these symptoms are treatable, easily fixable, and we have modern medicines that are very, very helpful to make things better for patients. So it's great that he came out and made public aware of this illness.
I have to say that's one of my pet peeves, is that we in the media very often, or even the American public, that we don't focus on anything until a well-known person comes out with it. But Governor Randall coming out and talking about this has definitely shined a light on Parkinson's disease. I want to talk about all the things that you had mentioned there, but do we know what causes Parkinson's disease?
We don't know the ultimate cause, but we have made enormous strides in understanding the disease very well. It turns out that there is an abnormal protein called alpha-synuclein, and this particular protein misfolds within the cell. And why it misfolds is still a mystery, but we know that the misfolding is the trigger. And this misfolded protein seems to accumulate within different cells in the body. Particularly, there is a cell in the brain called the substantia nigra, which produces a hormone dopamine. And if this alpha-synuclein accumulates to a sufficient quantity within the cell is destroyed because the cell is no longer able to handle this misfolded protein. And that is thought to be the underlying pathology. We also have made some enormous strides on understanding how the alpha-synuclein makes its way to the brain. We think it might originate in the gut, for example, in the stomach.
Really?
Yes. So research here at the Hershey Medical Center, my own work with my collaborator, Alberto Travagli, has shown that potentially the protein accumulates first in the stomach, and then it makes its way up into the brain via what we call the vagus nerve. And going up into the brain via the vagus nerve, it reaches a place called the dorsal motor nucleus of the vagus, and from there it goes to the substantia nigra. So we are doing all kinds of research to see if that can be a pathway that we can interrupt to cause Parkinson's to stop from progressing.
Can I interrupt for just 1 second? I mean, that's so interesting that something, a protein that would originate in the midsection in the gut, that makes its way to the brain. Are there other illnesses? Are there other diseases, other conditions where that occurs?
Well, that's an interesting question. We don't know that for sure. This particular idea of a protein moving up through the gut into the lower part of the brain, what we call the medulla, and from the medulla to the brainstem, was first put forth by Brock and Brock, two neuropathologists who were in Harvard. They put this hypothesis called the Brock hypothesis. It's gaining more momentum lately in the last 10 to 15 years, and that led to this discovery. And we made an animal model in our lab with Dr. Travagli's help, and we are now showing that this can actually be the causative pathway, which is very interesting. So we may have new treatments. For example, in Denmark, there was a study that when patients underwent vagotomy, the vagus nerve was cut for other reasons, for diseases of the gut, and then they followed these patients long term. They found out that majority of these patients were spared from Parkinson's disease. Not that we are advocating cutting the vagus nerve, but it proved the point that perhaps this is a pathway in which these proteins are moving up.
So, as you were just talking about some of the research into the causes. You also said that this is something that manifests itself usually age 60 to 65. I understand there are some other factors. gender, job, where you live, head injuries, that all those things can be contributing factors, correct?
That is correct. Of those things that you mentioned, perhaps the most important, most relevant to our area here is the rural nature of central Pennsylvania. Well water drinking has been implicated as one of the risk factors.
Well waters?
Yes.
Really?
And the idea is that city water or treated water is treated, and therefore some of the pollutants, contaminants are taken out. Well water, on the other hand, the pesticides and insecticides that are sprayed on our crops can enter groundwater and then get into well water, and that can be a risk factor. Not that you have to just drink that to get the Parkinson's, but it's one of the risk factors, which means if you already have other risks, you add on to the additional risk of well water drinking, you might be at risk for increased risk for Parkinson's disease. So that's one thing. Head injury, there's mixed debate about it. There has been some notion that perhaps boxing, for example, without protection can lead to Parkinson's disease. There's also the idea that if you played contact sports and you had head injuries, that can produce Parkinson's disease. Again, there's mixed literature on it. There is increasing evidence that, yes, it can be a risk factor. However, the prototypic example, Muhammad Ali, our great boxer.
That's what I first thought of when you mentioned it. Yeah.
Right. When you think about him having Parkinson's, he just happened to be a boxer who got Parkinson's disease. He did not get Parkinson's because of his head injury, at least based on what we know now. I was fortunate enough to take care of him as a fellow when I was in Emory University in Atlanta with my mentor, Dr. Malin DeLong. And this was a big debate with him and his family as to whether he got Parkinson's because he did unprotected boxing. And it turns out that he actually had classic idiopathic Parkinson's disease. The disease would have happened even if he wasn't a boxer. And there are some differences between boxing-related Parkinson's and the Parkinson's that occur naturally. So he appeared to have the boxing-related injury that was different from the Parkinson's disease itself. That's the conclusion we came to. He responded well to medicine. He did really well to medicines, although he was not the most compliant patient taking medicines. So we
just learned something in the background. Muhammad Ali was not good at taking medicine. Huh? So you actually examined Muhammad?
Yes, I did. I was a fellow with Dr. Malin DeLong, who was my mentor. So I did examine him, and he came for several visits with his wife, Lonnie. So that was quite an experience, yeah.
Something you mentioned, though, that I wanted to touch on. By the way, before I do that, we were talking about risk factors, and I mentioned gender. White men seem to get Parkinson's disease more often than other racial groups or women. That's one thing. You mentioned rural areas could have something to do with well water. But that exposure to pesticides, that may be one of the reasons there are farmers that seem to get it most often, exposure to pesticides. I also understand that there has been research that has shown that those who have been exposed to Agent Orange, for example, a lot of Vietnam veterans, that it does contribute, or they seem to have more cases of Parkinson's disease.
I'll take the last point. Agent Orange is less clear, but however, many of the other agents, for example, rotenone, which is a rat poison that we frequently use, paraquat, another herbicide that is frequently used in crops, although less so in United States. And there's been other toxins. There's been toxin called 6-hydroxydopamine. There's another toxin called MPTP. So these types of toxins seem to play a role. How exactly they contribute to Parkinsonism and Parkinson's disease is still not completely delineated. But it is true that when we expose animals to these toxins, they do develop Parkinsonism, and that's used often to model the disease. It's also true that, for example, paraquat, which I mentioned earlier, when exposed to rats, will give rise to these alpha-synuclein inclusions. There's a protein misfolding that I mentioned before. It will cause. In fact, in our animal model, we actually use paraquat paraquat, and if we ingest the animal with paraquat, if we orally give it to the animal develops alpha-synuclein in its gut, and then it travels up into the brain. So yes, there is some risk to being exposed to pesticides and herbicides. That's true.
Let's take a call from Norman in Lancaster. Norman, you're on the air.
Thank you, Scott. The doctor talked about the connection between the gut, the head, and the brain. Is there research being done as far as the issue of gut microbes, food eaten, and the brain-gut connection, such as high fiber obviously changes the gut microbes in the stomach, as do other foods? What about this as a possible treatment area?
Thank you very much for your call. We've actually gotten several questions about diet and nutrition.
That's a great question, Norman. So I'll answer Norman first, and then I'll go to the general question about the diet. So yes, there is some accumulating data that gut flora, particularly certain types of microorganisms, can be a risk factor for Parkinson's disease. So a recent experiment, they actually took, and this may not be very appealing for people to hear, but anyway, they took the feces from Parkinson patients and introduced it into mice. And it turned out these mice who had the vulnerable protein, misfolded protein, and these mice developed Parkinson's disease like symptoms. So it appears that the gut flora contributes, and there's a whole area of research going on to see whether this is something that needs to be investigated in terms of using certain antibiotics at all. But the more bigger question, is fiber important in the diet? Is certain foods need to be avoided at all? In general, people can eat whatever they want, but excess amount of protein, too much protein, like a high protein diet, is probably going to interfere with your medication. So if you're on Parkinson medications and you take a very high protein, so the kind of proteins that sports players take or sports drinks and sports meals, those kinds of meals probably will interfere with your medicines. High fiber diet, on the other hand, is important because many patients with Parkinson's disease have constipation, and taking the high fiber diet will actually improve. Also taking food that are rich in nutrients, for example, colorful vegetables, colorful fruits, with what we call anthocyanins, rich in anthocyanins, actually will be beneficial because that means that they will get more nutritional support to fight the disease. However, there's no real value in taking extra vitamins or other kinds of minerals. Unless you're deficient in something, there's no recommendation in terms of taking vitamins or mineral supplements.
Mm-hmm. Our guest during this portion of the program is Dr. Thyagarajan Subramanian, and he's a neurologist at Penn State Health's Hershey Medical Center. We're talking about Parkinson's disease. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Today's program is part of WITF's Transforming Health. For more on Parkinson's, plus a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health. From policy to personal choices, we're taking a comprehensive look at today's health system online at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, Penn State Health, and WellSpan Health. Doctor, wanted to follow up. You had mentioned the medications, and I want to get to that broad question of how Parkinson's is treated.
Yes. So that's a good segue to what I was going to say. There are wonderful treatments now. Most of the treatments are highly effective. One of the common medicines that we use is a medicine called carbidopa levodopa. It's a complicated name, but it's a precursor for the hormone that I mentioned before, dopamine. So when you take this pill, it goes into your stomach, gets absorbed, goes into the brain, and converts itself into dopamine. And that's how we are able to deal with the symptoms. In the last 200 years since Parkinson's disease has been discovered, the last 50 to 60 years has been particularly very fruitful in finding new treatments. And although carbidopa levodopa is about 50 years old or 60 years old, it still is the mainstay, but we have made better choices on how to use the medicine. We have made it easier for people to take it and less side effects. So in this day and age, most patients can take medicines and live lives that are completely normal, as again, the example of Mr. Randall wrote in his op-ed piece, he has been symptom-free for 3 years, and many of my patients have been symptom-free for almost 10 years to 15 years and doing really well so long as they take their medicines. So medication is number one. Number two, having good sleep habits, going to bed at the right time and waking up at the right time, and taking medicines absolutely precisely on time. Those three things will make a huge difference. Thirdly, doing exercise, a daily exercise regimen, and typically doing the same exercise again and again as opposed to a variety of exercises. So I recommend that they pick a stationary bike, put it in their house in the basement and ride them. This would make it easier for them to do the same exercise throughout the year as opposed to walking outside or running outside, because that is dependent on weather and it also depends on many other factors. So having a device or a machine or some kind of exercise regimen that you can do on a daily basis for at least half hour is absolutely critical and important, and that will make a huge difference in Parkinson's patients' lives. They don't necessarily have to do an outside sport, but if they are involved in an outside sport, that's just fine. So again, the three cardinal things that are good to treat Parkinson's medicines: one, medication, medication, medication. Number two, good sleep habits. And three, the exercise. These three things, if you do, I think most people do really well.
You know, I find it fascinating. It just seems as though, and maybe as a layman, just noticing it, but how important good sleep habits are. I mean, we're hearing so much more about that in the last 5 to 10 years, that how important sleep is. And in particular, Ed Rendell, I remember him famously saying that he would sleep 4 hours a night and could thrive for the other 20 hours a day and have energy. 4 hours a night just doesn't sound like enough to get by with this.
Correct. That would be absolutely right. It turns out that we have learned a lot about sleep and how it affects Parkinson's in the last few years. Parkinson patients have a particularly bad accompaniment of sleep disorder called RBD, REM behavioral disorder. What happens in this case is that these patients act out their dreams. So when they dream, they move, they kick, they scream, yell, etc. And that happens because of the dopamine dysregulation in the brain. Having good sleep habits and being able to sleep on the right time and waking up at the right time actually is a big benefit for people who have RBD. RBD can happen even 10 years before they came down with tremor and bradykinesia. And therefore, treating it is important because it will improve the amount of dopamine in their brain and help their medicine regulate their symptoms better.
So is that a symptom if people act out their dreams?
Yes, it could be a symptom. It could be what we call a preclinical symptom. So before you make the diagnosis of Parkinson's disease, some people would act out their dreams, kick and scream and box and so on and so forth. Like they may typically have a chasing dream. Somebody's chasing them in their dream and they act out their dreams. This RBD could be a precursor for Parkinson's disease. Constipation is another precursor for Parkinson's disease. Loss of smell is another precursor for Parkinson's disease. So if you have all three, loss of smell, RBD, and constipation, you certainly should think about seeing a doctor for it.
That you probably, I don't know, a lot of people would say, oh, I do that at night with the dreams. Go to a doctor, a sleep doctor, first of all, or get a sleep study, or what?
A neurologist would be just fine, you know, and usually a neurologist taking good history and going over this would be able to tell whether it's RBD, REM behavioral disorder, and they can also check you for Parkinson's, and they can tell.
All right. We have about 2 minutes left. Mike is in Landisville. Mike, I only have about a minute or so for you.
Sure, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Question, if there's any correlation of military service and Parkinson's like there is with ALS, and with ALS, over 50% of people diagnosed are veterans.
Thank you for your call.
Right. So that's a great question. This is an area of much research going on. There is suggestion, as I mentioned before, that traumatic brain injury can be a risk factor for Parkinson's disease. So if you have many concussions during your military service or you are vulnerable to concussions, yes, it could be a risk factor. Again, this is an area of research, but it's not proven that any particular military service actually leads to Parkinson's disease. The VA has a very strong program, research program, to look into it, and there are active research going on. I would consider participating in some of these research.
Last time you were here, 2 years ago, I look back on things we talked about. At that time, you were talking about stem cell treatments. Any progress there? And I have about a minute left.
Yes, we have made substantial progress in stem cell. There's actually 3 clinical trials going around the world. Our lab is also very active in stem cells. We have created 2 new stem cells that we're testing in the animal models. One is the one which can control from outside, another one that we can control internally using gene therapy. So we're making progress, and I think the clinical trials will be very illuminating because we will find out whether we can replace those dying cells in the brain, and that would be a major advance in the field because we don't have a way to replace cells that are dying in Parkinson's disease and being able to create the circuitry.
I understand that you have an event this weekend?
Yes. There is a symposium, a Parkinson's symposium. We're going to be talking about a lot of these things that we just talked about today, but in much more detail. We have a guest, Dr. Melinda Gonker, who's coming. It's on Saturday morning, 9 to 12. It's at the Hershey Medical Center conference unit, and it's free. There's no cost, and anybody can come in and register for the event.
Dr. Thayer Garajan Subramanian, thank you very much for being with us today. Coming up on tomorrow's program, actually, I'm going to be off tomorrow, but Katie Meyer, WITF's Capitol Bureau Chief, will be here. A lot happened at the state capitol this week. Looks like we could have a state budget on time for the first time in years. That's amongst the topics that Katie will discuss. I'll be back on Monday. By the way, next Friday, Nick Foles of the Eagles.